my way to go. Don't give them any rooms.
Yeah. Okay, so first up, we have Chris Blair.
Good morning, everybody. I think I might have stayed a little bit too long at karaoke last night, so you'll forgive me if I get a bit hoarse from having sung Sweet Caroline at 11 30 or something like that last night. But that's sort of part of the narrative, right? My first computers and writing conference was in 1992 in Indianapolis, and I have been coming back, obviously, for more than 20 years, and I think it is that spirit of fun and collegiality that keeps bringing me back and keeps allowing so many of us to bring those next generation backs with us. I have to say my funnest computers and writing, El Paso in 1995, Detroit in 2007, Davis in 2009, and part of that is obviously because of alcohol consumption, but also because, don't edit that part out. You edit that part out. Then I can look at some of you in the room as my partners in crime. But I really, more seriously, want to focus on several micro-historical moments of CNW's history. And I have a bit of a script so that I don't pull one of those John Boehner moments and start crying. Because these are really emotional types of stories, I think, as Cheryl alluded to. But the ones that I want to address include a sense of the field's inclusiveness, and the role of computers and writing as a feminist field. So I'll give a couple of examples of that. In 1994, when I was a very new assistant professor, Gail Haywisher, who's, it's so wonderful to see you at this conference, Gail, and Patricia Sullivan invited me to participate in an online research group called Women at Way Too Fast. Some of you might be familiar with that, may have participated in it. Its goals were to find a space to discuss online power relationships for academic women representing different career levels, from graduate student to full professor. I was honored to be among this research group as a very new, newly minted PhD, in particular because it led to Gail and Pat's publication, Women on the Networks, searching for e-spaces of their own in the collection Feminism and Composition, in other words. As much as this project was meant to be and was indeed inclusive, that doesn't mean that within this space and with others, there weren't those who didn't feel that they could share all aspects of their life stories, both personal and professional. And sometimes those were based on particular types of cultural markers that went beyond academic rank. This was most evident in the response by Joanne Addison and Susan Hillegoss, both of whom came out on the Way Too Fast list and then felt compelled to write about that process in the collection that Pam Takeyoshi and I edited, Feminist Cyberscapes, in 1999. And I mention this because their chapter then went on to win the Ellen Nold Award in 2000. I'm also focusing on these moments because in many ways, I think, again, it represents the spirit of the computers and writing community in that it celebrates diverse perspectives on the field, and also that we should not presume that the sense of community we might feel as long-timers, notice I did not say old-timers, is felt by those representing diverse academic and cultural identities. And I felt this most keenly at the 2013 CNW hosted by Jill Morris at Frostburg State, who was willing to bring forth these concerns about gender and identity politics, as were others, in ways that led to new discussions, both online and off, to not presume that our unique experience of the conference and the field represents everyone's experience of it. And I think that that type of articulation is important to foster inclusive spaces going forward, as Gail and Pat did then, as Gail and Cindy Dickie and Janice and Michael and Cheryl and so many other people in this room have done. That goal enables new spaces such as, oh, does that mean I'm done? That goal enables people like Tracy Gardner and Angela and Janice on the GRN and the role of various caucuses to ensure that that commitment to inclusion and social justice is more than just passive rhetoric, but is actually an active reality as we welcome new voices to this field and help mentor them so that they sustain the profession. Thanks so much.
So I've heard my whole career about how computers compare to print text, right? And I've heard things like, well, things disappear from computers, and they don't disappear when they're in printed form. I've heard it all, right? Believe me, I've heard a lot. It doesn't count on computers, where it does count in books. We've heard that one. And I want to just question that a little bit today. We've also, I guess, heard that computers don't have to do with humanism. And books, especially printed books, especially in the humanities, apparently do have to do with humanism. Well, okay, so I've heard all these things. I want to sit here today and I want to look at an artifact and examine those claims. This is my artifact. This is the history book. It's 1979 to 1994. Jason is smiling because he probably used it. It's in tatters, and it usually sits on my shelf with a rubber band around it so I don't lose it. And it has bite marks from the dog. It is, the pages look something like this. And when I look at this history book, 1979 to 1994.
Well, the first time she did 1984.
Yeah.
1979.
1984. Well, it's 94. It is 94. And it does remind me that we haven't done a history project in our field since 1994. That's 22 years. Right, yeah. Oops.
Yeah.
Exactly. And when we did this history book, we had to go back and we had to get people to go into their, like, closets and get the stuff out of their closet, the floor of their closet, to get the artifacts. And here we are yet again, 22 years later, and nobody has done a follow-up history of this community. I think that's important. In fact, it was for me doing this book that sort of solidified an understanding of our field and who we were as a group, where we had come from, where we were going to. So I don't want this group to lose history. Even though we generally look very forward, we're always looking forward. So I want another history book, or not a book, I don't want a book. A history project. A multimodal history project, and I think we have to start collecting those artifacts right away. The other thing I would say is this book contains a lot of things, but the most important part of the book is something that nobody ever notices. And I'll hold it up for you. I'm not sure you can see it. But in the front and the back cover of the back cover of this book are listed all the names of the people that we had worked with for those first XDX years, right, when we were working in the field. We probably didn't get it all right. We probably left some people out. We probably put some people in.
I looked at Frederick Jameson.
Yeah, right. The impulse was the right impulse. The impulse was to look for the people and not at the technologies, including, I might add, the technology of the book. The technology is not the field. Technology is not the heart of the field. It is the field. It's you out there. So do it again the next 50 years and do a project like this going forward. I just want to add an addendum to what Cindy was saying. When we were doing this book, okay, that she's showing it to you, our print book, she said to me, Gail, she said, wouldn't it be nice? She said, this is what I envision when it's done. We're going to have this hard copy of book with the hard back covers on it, and it's going to be blue, and we're going to have gold going across it. And won't that, you know, give it, it'll be a lasting book. And also to start where Cindy left off, that sort of all of us, you know, have really worked, you know, to build this field. And I
title of the short thing that I'm going to talk about now, A Memory of the Making of a Discipline. That sounds very grand, huh? Collaboratively. Okay, and the most important word there is collaboratively, because as Chris has noted and Cindy has noted, it's all of us, the now and into the future. Okay, so in those early years, when Cindy and I would talk, and talking about building a discipline, and when we were really using those grand words, we were just talking about what we were going to do next and so forth, but we did note that other disciplines are marked by journals, conferences, research and theoretical underpinnings, book series, books and articles, all of them as devoted to the field. They're not always marked by an attention to pedagogy. And this is what I love about our field, computers and writing, and which also is in rhetoric and composition and in writing studies. That makes us unique, and I think it really adds to our collaboration. Somebody asked me yesterday, why is our field so, you know, collaborative? And I think a lot of it does have to do with the fact that we share a pedagogy. Our research might be different, our theories might be different, but the pedagogy we share. Okay, and as Cheryl's already mentioned, the C&W conference, which is now 32 years old, that was really one of the first entities of the making of this discipline, because that was back, you know, in 1984, right? Okay, but the rumblings of this new discipline, they were all occurring as early as the 1970s, with Hugh Burns, as you know, with his 1979 dissertation, Stimulating Invention in English Composition Through Computer-Assisted Instruction, and sort of tell us. And Ellen Knowles, Three C's, 1975 article, Fear and Trembling, The Humanist Approaches a Computer, and she does say the humanist, so with that, so you won't be surprised, you know, that the first two awards that Computers and Composition gave out were the Best Dissertation Award, the Hugh Burns Award, and the Ellen Knoll Best Article Award, as Chris has mentioned. And Chris will be giving out a total of 5 awards tonight from Computers and Composition and from Kairos as well. Okay, but I want to just tell you a short memory of mine that goes back to the beginning of these awards, okay, which was in 1990, and I was just on the faculty of Purdue University, which Kathy will remember when I joined the faculty there. Okay, so I was going to my first rhetoric and composition meeting that Janice Lauer, you know, had set up and so forth, and I was so excited to be doing that, and I said, oh, and so when I came to my turn to say something, I announced those awards and so forth with great excitement, and Janice looked at me and she said, Gail, and she sighed, and she said, you know, we really usually give out awards to people who are no longer with us. This is highly unusual. And she sighed again. But fortunately, she was a great fan of both Hugh and of Ellen. And she said, well, maybe it will work out. Okay. So we're glad to say that it did work out okay. I'm going to stop now. But I'd love to hear from you when we have the discussion time, what directions you think the field should be heading in now to continue building this discipline of ours. Thank you.
When does this start? When does it start?
As soon as you turn around and start talking.
So.
She's already
so I will never again be on a program following the two of you.
That's true.
It's always hard to follow these guys, but it's really an honor to do it. I have a visual aid, thanks to Lisa Burton from Bedford St. Martin's. Thank you so much. I'm going to talk about this book. It's an old book. I love books. Most of you who know me know that I love books. Digital forms and print forms. I love books. They're wonderful things. So, I'm going to talk about this. I'm going to pass it up. If someone can make sure I get it back, Cindy autographed it. She's the only person that is here that's in that book. She's in that book.
Mike, I'm not sure they'll be able to hear you in the back.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll yell more loudly. Sorry. That book is really cool, and Cindy just signed it. She's the only person at the conference who's in that book, and it gives a sense of just the history of all of this. It's really wonderful.
What is the year?
1984. So, I tell my friends that I'm an accidental professor. It's true. In 1985, my wife decided to go to graduate school at a place I'd never heard of, Carnegie Mellon University, and I tagged along. That was good, and not just for my marriage. It was because of my wife that I applied to CMU's doctoral program, and it was because of the people I met there that I became part of the computers and writing community. In my first semester at CMU, Chris Neuwirth's seminar on computers and composition introduced me to people who had become a central part of my academic life. Chris used Bill Rush's 1984 collection, The Computer in Composition Instruction, A Writer's Tool, to explore key ideas in the field. This was a time when word processing software was in its infancy. It was well before Gail Heyscher had figured it all out. When helping writers generate ideas and review and comment on drafts was still getting started. And when we were just beginning to recognize the pedagogical implications of computer networks. Thanks to a CMU program that brought leading scholars to campus each year, it was great. They would bring these folks in for a semester or a year. They got to meet with just incredible people. I was able to spend time with some of the people who contributed to Rush's books, in particular Helen Schwartz. The same program brought Nancy Kaplan and Trent Batson to CMU, and through them I met other members of the community. Trent Batson and his ENFI project, which is Super Electronic Networks for Interaction and came out of Gallaudet University, put me in contact with Terry Collins, Jeff Cirk, and Chip Bruce, among others. It turns out I used to sell size 14 Quad E shoes from my running store to Terry Collins. It was amazing. We looked at each other and said, I said, 14 Quad E's. This is a true story. And through Nancy Kaplan, I met Stuart Moulthrop and Michael Joyce and J. David Bolter, who were among the early leaders in hypertext. And there were happy accidents. My advisor asked me to drive Carol Birkencotter and her colleague, Cindy Self, who I'd never met before, to the Penn State Conference on Rhetoric and Composition. This was in 1988. I recall a long conversation with Cindy about flaming and student anonymity. And I recall missing a few turns and ending up somewhere near West Virginia. This is true. Before we finally found our way to Happy Valley. At that point, I was sure my career was over. That was my first talk, too. I couldn't have been more nervous. It was crazy. Well, I was still a graduate student, though, again, participating in the discussions taking place on BitNet. Inevitably, I started arguing with people. I recall some exchanges with Fred Kemp about the value of showing every character as you typed it during chat. Fred was kind to me about my foolishness. Sure he was. Through Fred, I met still more members of the CMW community, among them Hugh Burns, another contributor to this book, Joyce Locke Carter, Paul Taylor, Wayne Butler, and John Slayton. I only have 30 seconds left. When I arrived at Colorado State University in 1990, I had the opportunity to work with more of the people who were in Rush's book. Kate Kiefer, who helped establish the Fifth C and co-founded Computers and Composition with Cindy, Charles Smith, and Don and Ray Rodriguez. They mentored me as I worked for a tenure and collaborated with me on articles, books, and research projects. When my son was young and things were going well, he often said, I'm a lucky guy. Seriously. I'll say the same thing today. I'm lucky my wife brought me to graduate school. I'm lucky I worked with Chris Neuer. I'm lucky I read Bill Resch's book and got to know so many of the people in it. This is a great community, and I'm lucky to be a part of it.
I invited Fred to come rabble rouse, but he couldn't make it.
Like Mike. I'm also an accidental professor. The book on our history that Cindy was talking about ended in 1994. My first foray into academia began in 1994. When at the age of 43, I finished my bachelor's degree and started grad school.
and met. So even though I'm of an age or older than the first generation of CMW scholars, I guess I'm actually a second generationer.
Yeah.
All right. So my first professional conference was my first year in the MA program. It was in the spring of 95. I went to Four Seas. And it seemed I had already met the computers and writing folks online in MOOCs. It seemed at Four Seas, though, that our discipline, all of our presentations were in the basement of the conference. The following year, I didn't go to El Paso CMW that year, and that's something I have always regretted.
Me too.
Especially
the mechanical bolt.
Exactly. No, but I got I got that one. Gail and Cindy riding a mechanical bolt. Okay. So the following year, I went back to Four Seas, and I signed up for the Research Network Forum because I had, you know, really got enamored of all this computer stuff. I was teaching in a computer classroom, the only computer classroom they had at USF, and I was using MOOCs in the classroom. And so I decided I was going to do this really cool project, study of a MOOC in a first-year writing classroom. And I took it to Research Network Forum to get some feedback on this project. And they're looking at me like, okay, so what's a moo? What's a listserv? Why would anybody want to use computers in a writing classroom? A few months later, I found myself at my first ever Computers and Writing Conference. That was 96. I've never looked back. And I didn't have to explain any of these things. I found a home where I could talk about the things that I was interested in. I could talk with people who were, you know, my heroes, heroines in the field. All of the people that I had been reading about and talking to online. And they knew what I was talking about, and I could learn from them. Many of us were grad students at the time. Nick Carbone, Eric Crump, Todd Taylor, lots. But a lot of the people that are stars in this field were still grad students at the same time I was, even if they were a little younger. But we were often alone on our campuses with no one that we could actually talk to other than, okay, Joe Moxley, who was my major professor and directed my dissertation and first sent me to learn about computers and writing my first semester in grad school. But other than that, who could we really talk to about our projects? Are you kidding?
You get another minute for the mechanical bull story.
Okay. So we started thinking that there ought to be something like Research Network Forum at Computers and Writing Conference, something that would provide a space for those of us doing work in this field to get the feedback that we needed from knowledgeable peers. And guess what that was? The Graduate Research Network was born in 2000 at Dallas-Fort Worth. This was our 17th GRN this year. We had about 80 people. That is not our record. We've had over 100 at some conferences. We're still going strong. We've got a whole new generation of CMWers who have come through that. Some started as grad students at GRN and are now full professors.
Give away how many thousands of dollars a year?
The Travel Grant Fund began in 2004 when I had asked Bedford for some money to help pay for the programs, and I had extra, so I gave it away. And Cindy
said, you know, why don't we do something bigger to raise money, because the next year was in Hawaii. And we began the Travel Grant Fund. We give away $8,000 to $10,000 a year to help graduate students. We're still going strong. And I guess I'm out of time.
Yeah.
So.
Hi, my name is Will Hoffman. I'm just going to say a few quick things. In fact, you can use my extra time, Cheryl. But I want to say that I came to this community via Megabyte University, loving email. I still love email. I know listservs are a little bit out of date or passe, but that's where I've lived my life. So I put a poem in Computers and Composition somewhere in the 90s. You know, it's hard to remember because I was hanging out with Prince so much, but this is called Shark Boy Hombre, and I'd just like to read it for Mike Palmquist, Nick Carbone, and Jonathan Alexander, three amigos who have helped me start a life in the community. And this is my home. I'm home, and I'm happy, and you're my family. I love you. That's a good way to get people to like a poem. I probably live best on email these days. I don't live wonderfully otherwise. I just feel victimized by my liver, pollution, and not doing enough beyond couch and screen, except I do go on, appearing neatly at work on working dawns each and every week, almost swimmingly. Like my father, I'm not really the hombre with technical hobbies. And like my brother, I'm not always enough the sea lover. Yet like my mother, I swim with my heart anyway. Why not cry my family electric into your own oceanic reply? Maybe I'm more than just some modern shark boy, rancher fishing lines for those ripe online remarks to stake your sick posts into, with fences like nets to follow. And the last thing I'm going to read is, I think we all found our way into computers and writing world because we love literature and we love writing. And sometimes we don't recognize that well enough. But to me, I'll always be both and everything. And I came to computers and writing, the first presentation I made was I sing the poetic electric, or I sing the electric poetic, I still don't remember. But I was ripping off Walt Whitman left and right, and I still do as much as I can. So I'd just like to read A Noiseless Patient Spider. A noiseless patient spider, I'd marked where on a little promontory it stood, marked how to explore the vacant, vast surrounding. It launched forth filament, filament, filament out of itself, ever unreeling them, ever tirelessly speeding them. And you, oh my soul, where you stand surrounded, surrounded in measureless oceans of space, ceaselessly musing, venturing, throwing, seeking the spheres to connect them, till the bridge you need be formed, till the ductile anchor hold, till the gossamer thread you fling catch somewhere. Oh, my soul.
So honored to be among all of these wonderful, wonderful scholars and people more than anything. There's like five or six seats up here. If any of, I won't be offended if any of you want to do some shuffling while I'm talking. It's totally fine. There's a couple over here. There's some spots. I'm going to talk about a post-human moment that happened before we decided there was post-humanism. So this is 1993, and I'm going to start with an artifact as well, which is a Next computer. And if any of you are unfamiliar with the early Unix machine called the Next computer, there was one that sat in the basement at the University of Texas. And here's the post-human moment. It had a name. The name was auden.en.utexas.edu. And I'll always remember that URL or that domain name, And two things that are significant about it. One, the EN, the English department, had a subdomain at the University of Texas, probably along with CS, computer science, and those are probably the only two entities at this university that were doing this stuff. And that's a really important lesson for us. I think it's, you know, we are leaders, not followers, when it comes to digital humanism. And that's something we always need to pay attention to and make sure that we're aware of that. The other thing is that computer sat in this really great space that was a basement, which is kind of an alternative space. And in that space, it welcomed newcomers. So I was a graduate student thinking I was going to do literary criticism. And people said, come try this. Do this other stuff and see what happens. It's a bottom-up discipline. It's not a top-down discipline. Always has been bottom-up. And I encourage all of you, even today, as you go into these sessions, click on the website, volunteer to review a session, post something, publish your proceedings, whatever you want to do, you are the ones who are going to drive it. So this is the bottom-up way that this discipline works. The other thing about that space was it was a wonderful pivot space because it was looking backwards and forwards. In that space, it was at this kind of flux moment, the Daedalus integrated writing system was wrapping up in some ways as local networks were kind of transitioning to a global network model. And that needs to be in art history. There was this sort of like crucial kind of pivoting there. And what was happening at that pivot was the transition of tool building, which even though we're about people and we're about ideas, we're also about things. And the tool building is a very, very strong strain in our DNA that bubbled up and is ongoing now. I know in this room there's four or five like major, really interesting tool building projects. And if something isn't working for what we need pedagogically or scholarly, then we make it. And if we can't make it, we find someone who can help us make it. So there's that tool building history that is so valuable to our field. And I, you know, everyone's already been named. The people I would like to reference have already probably been referenced here. I'll maybe make one reference. But the last part, and I appreciate following Will on this, was that, you know, the EN and the Auden, there's a literary reference in there as well. And the other thing, we used that next server and started to build on the web and figured out you could add a comment form. What a novel thing. The web is a flat thing. All you do is read your passage. Suddenly, you write a script and you can put stuff back into it and make a transaction happen. And so that was really valuable. And on that server, we also started playing around with MUDs, which were unbelievably strange to me. I had no idea what this was, but someone said, oh, it's like creative writing. You kind of describe a phrase, you get in there. And you know, I never really followed through with that, but I worked on it for a little while, and the idea was you could try anything if you want. You should try everything, so at least you know what people are talking about. So we worked on those MUD things, and the impetus there was to embrace creative production, and I think that's something that our field has always valued. And at the 93 Computers and Writing Conference, I did a little presentation about MUDs, and I spoke creatively. And afterwards, someone came up to me and said, you should do more of that, which was really encouraging. Instead of saying, why are you off base? Why aren't you citing X, Y, or Z? They said, go for it. Do more of that. And that was John Slayton.
No, yeah. Is 93 Missouri or 94?
Missouri, whatever the year
was. Missouri. Okay,
yeah.
It was Missouri.
Can we unmute the projector?
Okay.
And I promise you it's not huge, but I can't even see the screen now.
This is his way of getting more than 4 minutes.
Okay. Well, I'm going to take you back to 1993 as well. And thank Dan for setting me up with the new and all that. The hinge moment of historical significance to the community. Yeah, it's this
one. That one?
Yeah, that's it. It has two parts. They're both 1993, when we really learn to play online in text-based environments, especially how we learn how to use play to inform our work. And in short, 1993 was a hinged moment. It was a Kathy Yancey, we have a moment, in which we learned to use ludicity to achieve lucidity. The first part is excerpted from the first ever C&W online conference in 1993 when Bill Condon and others chaired the conference. And he invited us to let the group, let them know how we feel in virtual environments. And feel we did, we often took recourse in metaphors of navigating physical space, such as haunted houses or exploring caves roped together, and witness what some of us said in discovering our online playfulness. Eric Crump said, "Feel a little awkward in this system and suspect that if this were a non-virtual parlor, I'd probably knock over a vase or track mud on the rug." And I said, "I feel disoriented. I'm not knocking over vases or tracking mud on the carpet of this virtual parlor so much as trying all the wrong doors with keys that wouldn't fit anyway. In short, I'm following Eric, following Bob Child, and I hope we're all roped together." And Chris Holt said, "I'm having so much fun in this conference that my colleagues are beginning to worry about my sanity. Wish I could just drop everything and play in your virtual parlor all day." And Bob Child said, "Yikes, follow me at your own risk. I'm the one who overloaded the network Saturday night and got us all dumped out." Ildana Hamilton said, "I too am feeling more comfortable than I did, but to wander away from the virtual parlor analogy, I sometimes feel like a spelunker whose lamp flickers or goes out, leaving me feeling somewhat in the dark." Anne Green said, and this is Bill Condon, not Anne Green, actually, "Help, I've fallen into a virtual space and I can't get out." We co-chairs can't believe how complicated this has turned out to be. A warning to Eric Crump, next year's chair. Eric said, "Warning taken, my head's spinning. Already just thinking about it, but of course, I'll have the advantage of your experience and precedence." Mike Morgan said, "Okay, Eric and Jeff, let's not keep it to ourselves. Let's share. What the heck is a media move? Some kind of multimedia cow?" Okay, let's move down here. "Some kind of a multimedia cow, a bovine cousin of Apple's agent?" Glenn Meyer said, initial reaction, "I'm a bit worried to see that Eric Crump had some trouble with his system. I lurk on a few lists. But I followed Eric's instructions to some interesting places, including Mulan. I thought I was going to talk to him there yesterday in the TR lounge, but the virtual Eric turned out to be a duck." Eric Crump said, "Hey, Glenn, that duck is me. And we could all be in big trouble here because I'm following Bob Child around and you're following me around. And if Bob makes some really wrong move, we could all go tumbling off some virtual cliff. Don't trip, Bob." This is also the year that we discovered real-time online academic discussion in IRC and MOO. After CW93 online, events that led to the Tuesday Cafe and the Tech Ret Barn, we embraced our ludic and playful sides and profited from that as a discipline in countless articles and books, in our teaching, and much more. And then Eric and Becky published, where am I going? Okay, they published, "It's fun to have fun, but you have to know how. How boarding on the net will save the academy." And Becky is sort of channeling Eric here and saying, "The most liberating aspect of the net is that it provides a place for us to explore the intertwining of seriousness and play for the benefit of both. Between the punning, the parodies, the verse, the gossip, are interspersed serious business. Richard Lanham said that interactivity compromises solemnity, and that's something that folks still mired in print, as well as that we who live on the net, ought to consider and value." Eric's final observations were that the playful, semi-irreverent banter found on lists, on MOOs, and IRC, on newsgroups, just might save academia from its own ponderous weight. "Without the net, the academy will sink into oblivion."
Yes.
And although MediaMoo, which lived under my desk at school for 15 years, is decommissioned, playing on the net, I think, has kept us alive and well, co-mentoring, collaborating, intertwingling, being lucid through the ludic. At describe us as techno-rhetoricians. Computersandwriting.org/memorabilia. It's there.
Yeah.
Okay? The history is there. Don't forget it.
Thank you. All right, I'm totally keeping you all the time because otherwise we're running over.
Okay.
We can't run over.
Now she says that.
Yeah.
Thank you. So just thanks to be included in this illustrious group. I don't plead guilty to the age. Also, I'll say you'll see some themes here, the 90s and pivots among them. In 1994, NCTE hosted three conferences on portfolios, one in Baltimore with Peter Elbow focusing on print, one in Scottsdale, Arizona, focusing on WAC with Marianne Smith and Bill Condon, and one in Indianapolis focusing on electronic portfolios with keynoters Gail Haywisher and Cindy Self. The good news was people actually came and they had something to talk about, which, you know, this was 22 years ago, not a small thing. Cindy and Gail were kind enough to invite me to guest edit an issue of Computers and Composition focusing on electronic portfolios that were defined by Alan Purvis, a prior president of NCTE, who in fact died the year that the issue came out. And he said, a portfolio is a hypertext. It comprises a number of text or artifact spaces created and arranged by the author. In education, the author is usually the student. The student creates a network among the artifacts. The student seeks to have the portfolio represent her, but, or and, viewers may rearrange the artifacts, make different connections, and comment on one or more of the artifacts or the ensemble. They may make a different web. The table of contents included, and in the list you will hear here many microhistorical themes, and some that have already been mentioned today, Alan Purvis's lead article, Electronic Portfolios, Tim Myers, From Page to Screen and Back, Portfolios, Data Lists, and the Transitional Classroom, Becky Howard, Memoranda to Myself, Maxims for the Online Portfolio, Katie Fisher, Down the Yellow Chip Road, Hypertext Portfolios in Oz, Joe Campbell, Electronic Portfolios, A Five-Year History, which was about an elementary school, and all the portfolios were housed on a CD, Cheryl Forbes, Co-Writing, Overwriting, and Overwriting in Portfolio Land Online, Beverly Wall and Robert Peltier, Going Public with Electronic Portfolios, Audience, Community, and the Terms of Student Ownership. Steve Watkins, World Wide Web Authoring and the Portfolio Assessed Internetworked Composition Course. Brian Hewitt, Computers and Assessment, Understanding Two Technologies. Pam Takayoshi, The Shape of Electronic Writing, Evaluating and Assessing Computer-Assisted Writing Processes and Products. One of the smart things she said was that the draft was an antiquated idea. The minute that you started writing, and I mean, that seems obvious, and it's certainly obvious at the time, but nobody else had actually said it before. And then my closing, which was called The Electronic Portfolio Shifting Paradigms, in which I made seven observations, which I think are still true today, which speaks to the ability of the field to not only look backward, but to look forward. And I would suggest that these observations speak to the astounding changes that we've not only witnessed, but also participated in during the last 20 years. First, together portfolios and the electronic are enacting paradigmatic shifts in literacy. Second, just as new writing processes and texts are being developed, so too are new reading processes, processes that again are not yet understood or narrated or articulated. Three, in the electronic portfolio, the role of the expert is being widened and expertise is being shared. Four, in the electronic portfolio, we see a continued focus on authentic assessment. Five, because of the electronic portfolio, writers and readers are taking on new roles and developing new identities. Six, as important, working in the electronic medium, we are being shaped in ways no one fully understands. Thank you.
Lisa has a video that I'll put on Twitter later. I couldn't get the audio working, so Tracy's up next.
I have this belief that, at least if you're of a certain age, when you tried to use computers with your class, you had to break a rule or do something sneaky. So you caused trouble. And I'm going to talk about the Troublemaker Award. When I was appointed chair of 7Cs, the 4Cs Committee on Computers and Composition and Communication, in 1999, I began work on implementing a suggestion from Marcy Bauman to give Fred an award to recognize his work. At the time, our field had the Computers and Composition Hugh Burns Dissertation Award, and we had the Ellen Old Best Article Award, but we didn't have anything that honored the body of work of anybody in our field. So I wrote a draft of guidelines for what became the Technology Innovator Award, though that name was not our first choice. Many committee members were in favor of Technology Pioneer Award, but I had gotten it in my mind, and maybe it's true, that everybody referred to pioneers and their wives, pioneers and their families, or just pioneer woman or pioneer women. So I was not having any of that. They thought I was crazy, but I was like, no. So we chose the Technology Exemplar Award. The 4C's liaison at the time about turned green when she saw that, and her eyes popped out of her head, and she said, you cannot use that name. The problem was that they were concerned that if we had an exemplar award, it would be confused with the 4C's exemplar award, and then, of course, all of our profession would have just collapsed. Heaven forbid that two things have the same or similar names. So we worked some more, and we finally came up with the current name, the Technology Innovator Award, but I've always called it the Troublemaker Award. And if you read the description of the awards, you will find both references to pioneers and troublemakers in that description. So once we had the name, I thought, okay, we're good now, except for the problem was I was brand new and didn't know what I was doing. So part of the trouble I make. I didn't realize that there were actually guidelines I was supposed to follow. So I had sort of just bounced this off. I think I turned it in my report for what we had done this year. We're doing this year. We're giving an award. And she's like, you can't give an award. So I finally turned something in, and it turned out that that wasn't complete either. And in particular, I hadn't bothered to include a budget because I thought, I'm just doing all the work myself. There is no money that's necessary. I was just going to pay for the plaque out of my own money, and everything was going to be good. That year, I also instituted giving the host for C&W a plaque, because I had seen that done at 4C's, and I was like, we need to step up our game. The hosts need to be recognized with a plaque for what they've done. So, I didn't have a budget either. So finally, after a while, I was really stubborn, and there were a lot of revisions and a lot of emails back and forth between our committee members and folks at 4C's, and then I had the most awkward phone call probably of my entire life with the 4C's chair at the time, Victor Villanueva, and I was terrified of him. And at one point in the phone call, I remember that he was like, okay, this is doable, and I was like, but we didn't really follow the rules. Are you sure this is okay? And he's like, I can make this decision. So... So the award got approved, fortunately, because Victor's a kind man, and I was just terrified for no reason. And in May 1999, at Computers and Writing in Rapid City, I surprised Fred Kemp with the inaugural award. The 7C's Technology Innovator Award is now in its 18th year of honoring colleagues who are innovators with technology in the classroom, or as I always like to call them, troublemakers. And I think it's fitting that the creation of the award is actually a tale of causing a lot of trouble.
Being here at this moment is tough for me because it's a reality check. I've been in the discipline since 1984 out of graduate school, and it's just, how did that happen? Those of you who just got here, it's going to be over in a second. But the one thing I'd like to say is that this is the best conference, I would say, right? Because of the community, and I agree with Dan that it's bottom up. Go for it, try it, you know, be innovative. I mean, that's the spirit of this community. But it's not completely bottom-up, because people like Cindy and Gail and, you know, others who follow them, Kathleen, you know, created a space that is a very nurturing and very loving. Like, Janice was a student of mine, I'm proud to say. She came to a conference with an idea about a citation system, and we were in a graduate class, and she came back and she said, they're adopting it. like this space here, it's like when you go to 4C's, you bump around and it's like being in an aircraft carrier. You don't know where you are, you don't know what room you're supposed to be at. But the point I wanted to make, following up on the idea of being a pioneer.
You're a man.
I grew up in Utah, so being a
pastor
is a little bit problematic. But this is the thing I wanted to comment on, is that, you know, people talk about having outcomes to an idea, or, you know, knowing its parameters. But I really think that there's a spirit of creativity and openness, a challenge that characterizes this discipline. And I think, like, you know, I go back, I was out of graduate school pitching a book on creative writing pedagogy, and I went out to dinner with Michael Spooner and Cindy. And she's like, hey, this computers and composition is going to be a thing. She's like, yeah, it might be. And she's like, we need a journal, right? We need a book. And I was like, whoa, that might be better than my creative writing pedagogy book. But so I don't think she knew it was going to become this. And then, like, you know, Jimmy Wales was in St. Pete. And I talked to him before Wikipedia was Wikipedia. And he's like, yeah, I got a server. I'm going to pitch this open source thing. I don't know. But it wasn't called open source. He said, I'm just going to, well, I wonder if we can have an encyclopedia. I don't think he knew back then. You know, came talking like, you know, I just didn't know. Ed Fox, who created the Network Digital Library of Theses and Dissertations, he had a real passion for accelerating knowledge. He felt like graduate students spent a lot of time building literature reviews. Nobody read them. So he created the NDLTD as an alternative to Bell and Howe. And, you know, I don't think he really realized what that was going to become, which, like, people like Simon Pockley, he was the first, like, viral dissertation. And it created global discussions about IRB and ethnographic practices. And, you know, because he had 2 million reads, this was in kind of the way that. I mean, I remember when I first saw the internet, I was like, oh my God, because, you know, I went over to college business and there was this computer and said, hey, there's this thing called the internet. You know, and I unfortunately didn't buy stock or anything like that. I saw this idea, right? And there was this coffee pot in CERN, Switzerland, I suppose, and you could see if the coffee was hot. Now, what a great invention. You know, I always love coffee. This is going to be good. And then I think, like, so I think about being open, like, you know, learning from your graduate students. It's, am I going to
close
the
line?
I'm going to start by making myself younger.
Yeah. It works.
I don't have a moment, but I have a theme. And you've heard some of this theme running through people's presentations. And my theme is graduate students. Graduate students, and the role that graduate students have had in the conference and in the community at large. So the most obvious one for a lot of us is Kairos. It was founded by graduate students.
Yes.
The masthead on the first issue was graduate students. Mick Doherty, Elizabeth Pass, Mike Selva, who was at SUNY Binghamton, Greg Searing, who is now a leader in teaching in technology centers, Corey Wick, Jason Teague, and Amy Hansen founded a journal that is still going 20 years. And it was one of the most important journals in the field because it was the first to embrace in a consistent and loving way, and loving I mean by the editorial process, where the process isn't to gatekeep, it's to open gates. The creation of web texts that are native. And you see that web technologies change and the journal has grown. The other thing you saw when Mike was talking about the MOOCs, that was a graduate student workshop that Eric and Becky led, where we talked about IRC. We left that workshop and went right into media when we dropped off IRC forever. And it was sustained by two graduate students on Tuesday Cafes, Greg Searing and Terry Vanderbilt. And for years, they kept us together every Tuesday night in ongoing discussions that often were reflecting what was going on in the email list. And then there was Eric Crump. Eric Crump was a graduate student who left the academia full-time, became a journalist. He sustains the tech rep list now. He keeps our community going with the tech rep list. He founded RepNet, which was a magazine experiment that's now archived at the WAC Baring House.
And he and Mick and others from those magazines were experimenting with new forms of article writing and publication that were natively interactive, ripping off email correspondence, setting up discussions that were archived and annotated and pushed out. So they created all this room for experimentation. Then hosting the conference. Rich Rice was a graduate student when he co-hosted, but I can tell you, did most of the work with Linda Hansen. I remember we flew the programs out, Bedford Upland programs. We flew them out in boxes. Denise Weicher and I drove them to Rich's house, and he had his colleagues all sitting there, and we were stuffing the programs into the bags to get to the registration in the morning. He was up all night getting the conference ready. Eric Crump hosted in 94. He was the first graduate student to host. Actually, no, he wasn't the first graduate student. When it was at U Texas, it was co-hosted by Hugh, John, and then these two graduate students, Locke Carter, who is now Joyce, and Wayne Buck, graduate students. And the other nice thing about the conference is when it was in Stanford in 2005, it wasn't hosted by a faculty member. It was hosted by Karina Rees, who was an academic technology specialist. So, Janae, when you get there. But that idea that you don't have to be a top of the game to be as important to the community is good. And so in GRN, I go every year, and there's really good stuff coming. There's really good stuff coming if you look at GRN. So you guys are doing a great job. Keep it up. And as a perpetual grad student who is ABB, and
yeah, I think just hit it. There we go. You might not get it on your screen.
Clever. I just want to see the pictures. Yeah. That's not going to work.
Can't you present online?
Oh, it's not on the computer, I see.
Bottom right.
Oh, she's trying to get you to expand.
That's good enough. I don't care. No, okay. I want you to see the picture. Okay, so yes, this is a wonderful community. Everybody loves each other. It's
very helpful.
I get to go last after all these people. Jeez. Okay, so it doesn't happen by itself. That's my main thing. You know, a welcoming community is that way because people work behind the scenes often. And I just want to encourage people to continue doing that because everybody's there's just a lot of great work that we don't even realize is happening. So this is a picture of DMAC, which is Digital Media and Composition, went on at OSU for 10 years, just finished the other day. And CWIC, which is its predecessor back at Michigan Tech, went on for many years. So what is it, like 30 years, right? Okay, so every year, you know, anywhere from 15 to 40 people would come to these places and stay for 2 weeks. And they would not just get their feet wet, they'd get up to their knees in theory and praxis and pedagogy and lots of nurturing. Okay, so that's not like the end all. That's just one example of many kinds of experiences that we create as a community for other people so that they don't just hear about us. They come in and they just leave fully charged, at least for the next week. To go out and do really good work and creative work, and it's a very creative group. So I want to challenge everybody who's coming up, mostly this will be people who are mid-career, to think about their own kinds of events that they can hold so people can come and really get invested in a certain area. And I had a couple of things listed, but at any rate, I did a little bit with K-12 teachers. It could be with gaming. It could be with coding. It could be with any number of things, and a lot of people are already doing that kind of stuff. We need to make it clear and visible that people are doing that work, and we need to do more creative work that way. And then the other one that I like, I guess I could just, of course, I worked for 10 years to do the digital pedagogy poster sessions at Four C's. And it wasn't just me. I mean, Doug Iman and I, for the last many years, were leading the charge with a computer connection and the DPP to get them to continue doing it. It's a struggle, right? Yeah. And you have to keep working with people. There's a new chair every year. You got to convince them this is a good thing, and you got to get everything lined up, and then you go through your own review process. So it's a lot of work with an institution that isn't just sort of in and of itself naturally inclined to do work that shows our projects in their best light. And I think digital, you know, presentation is the way we need to do it. That has a long history in itself. I mean, I think, I don't know when we started lobbying to try to get, you know, computers at Four C's, but it was a long time ago, and a lot of people put a lot of energy into it. Had a couple of presidents that had pushed it, and they still couldn't get it done. And finally, it happened. And the last two or three people that came through there were wildly supportive of our work, and that's going to continue. And we have great people, Stephen McElroy, Mo Folk, and Catherine Bridgman are going to take this stuff up, and they're gonna take it forward. But that's not the only institution we need to, push ourselves into. We need to go to other conferences that you hold dear, and we need to do the background work with the institutional people that set up those conferences and try to make our work doable at those places. So I want you to get out there and do it.
We have 1 minute left, and I apologize that we did not have time for discussion, but I know that you will appreciate that we've had all of these amazing voices. However, this is the beginning of this conference.
Yeah.
We have the entire weekend to continue this discussion.
I think with Nick talking about graduate students, that was so very, very important. And when Benny said, you don't have to be at the top of your game, you know, to participate. And the thing is, the graduate students are often the ones, and when you were a graduate student, they're at the top of the game. And
they're
so this is why we need them all to work with that middle generation that doesn't have that.
Our motto is, we do not protect graduate students, we involve them.
That's the perfect segue into our final announcement as you go on into your next sessions. I think if anything we've learned from this community is feminist and welcoming and encouraging from all levels. And Tracy Gardner is running our mentoring thing, network, this weekend. So if you, only you can hold the pool noodle. So if you need a mentor badge, Tracy has them. If you are a first-time attendee, please come let us know. She can give you a little badge. We can set you up with a mentor who can take you through the conference. I mean, not like we're going to hold your hand, but we're going to introduce you to people. We're going to help you navigate the things that will then become your first open door to the community. So thank you so much all
for
coming.
Thanks to Cheryl.
That was awesome.